Debbie Berry.
Here.
Bruce Sprinker.
Here.
Dan Moore is absent. Two members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have a motion to approve the minutes from our April meeting.
So moved.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
And we'll move on to the financial report, Bill.
Great. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, everyone.
Okay, we have our results through April 30th. Okay, so we have made up a little bit of ground on the property taxes for this year. We picked up about $500,000. This was the timing difference that we talked about. It went last year from a deficit year to date of 2.1 versus 2018 to about the 1.6 that you see here. Our charges for services, we actually continue to do pretty well this year, even with some of the weather that we've had. So across all the zoo, enterprise, and golf, we're up about $421,000 for the month of April. So this is nice progress so far. And again, we'll talk about the contribution from all three. It was pretty impressive as we get to the individual detail. And overall, we've taken our revenue, we've made some grounds of about $1.1 million that we picked up in April. So for a year to date, we're only about $419,000 off of where we were through April of last year. Jumping down to our operational expenses, you can see we tracked very, very comparably to April of 18. We're only $1,300 off. And again, we were consistent with where we were at the end of March when we looked at this for being about $1.6 million more in spend on operations than we were through April of last year. And then the operating surplus, this was a nice improvement, again, driven by revenue. We were at about 3.1 less of an operating surplus back in March. We've now narrowed that down to $2 million, so we continue to improve. And then from a capital standpoint, we've had a little bit slower start with some of our projects due to some of our counterparties working through some of the Tiger grants and our timing on being able to start those. We do have some nice activity that's starting now at the zoo in May. Those are not in these results yet, so we'll start to see this number pick up for capital investment as we get into the summer months. And then our net surplus position is approximately $1.6 million above, higher than it was April of last year. And again, we'll catch that up. That'll come back down as we get our capital spend. Looking at the zoo, again, attendance has been a bit of an issue for us. We need to see attendance come back up, but the nice part about this is we're actually ahead from a revenue perspective. The attendance that we are not seeing, it's down on free Mondays. It's down with zoo society members right now. Those are the non-paying attendees. So from a revenue perspective, we actually gained another $150,000 in the month of April, and we're about $382,000 up over April of 18 for year to date. When we look at our operating expenses, we came in favorably in April by about $132,000 better than April of last year. So we've reduced the amount of more spend this year versus last year through April by about $486,000. So we're at 6.3, we're at 5.8 through April of last year. And then our surplus accordingly, we've narrowed, we're about $105,000 more of a surplus than we were at this point last year. So really pretty comparable when you look at the operations for the zoo are trending well and consistently. Again, we'll see capital expenditures go up. We did start the rhino exhibit in May. We do have some pathways being paved in May, so that number will increase when we look at our main numbers. Jumping over to golf, strong revenue. We picked up another $143,000. $75,000 ahead of where we were last year at this time for year to date. So nice performance there, even though we've had between 3.5 and 5.5 inches of rain at any given course through April. So it's been another wet season, but not quite as wet as last year, if you remember how soggy that one was. So it's been interesting. Operating expenses, we did a little bit better in April versus April of last year, to the tune of $14,000. So overall, we're about $43,000 more in operating expense spend than where we were through year to date last year. And then from an operating subsidy perspective, we've improved. So we gained about $131,000 favorably, and we are at just about $700,000 in operating subsidy at this point. We were at $830,000 last year at this point. And again, we expect that at this point in the season, as we get into the busier months, we'll turn that around. And then obviously we've made our capital equipment purchases. Now we are significantly through the purchases of the golf carts. We accelerated a full year and we did the lithium battery carts. So this was some of the adjustments that we made coming into the year based on opportunity. Looking at our courses, Big Met, nice revenue increase over through year-to-date last year. We see the same thing at Manikiki, at Sleepy, at Shawnee, and at Seneca. So revenue performance has been pretty strong. When we look at, when we look at Sleepy, we do notice that we have a little bit of an uptick in the operating expenditures there, and the reason for that is we started the allocation of some shared personnel sooner in the year, this year than last. Namely for some of our concessions and operations, we're doing a more accurate spread of people's time per course. So Sleepy ended up picking up a little bit more of one of our individuals' time. And we also had another individual that went from hourly to full-time, so that is baked into the cost this year as well. So again, as budgeted, as expected for Sleepy. We did performance for golf. Then looking at enterprise. We gained about $119,000 in revenue over April of last year. So for the month of April, a strong month. We talked about we expected to see a couple of things turn, and we'll look at the individual divisions to see where that was. We're about $65,000 better than where we were through April of last year when we look at revenue year to date for our enterprise operations. Jumping down, we have now flipped for April of 18. We had a subsidy. We are at a surplus for April of 19. That's a $104,000 increase or improvement. And then from a year-to-date perspective, we are about $35,000 behind on a net basis for the surplus where we were last year, but we'll expect that to continue to improve as well. And then net basis, you can see our results here. We're at about $251 in net surplus. We're about $183 right now. That's a $68,000 delta, again, beginning of the season, so we can drive better results. This was nice to see change. I think we had some concern from comment in the past, at the beginning of this year, about performance of Merwin's. It's now ahead slightly of where it was for year to date through April of this year at 285 versus 280. And we can see that there is the subsidy of the 131,000, so we'll continue to drive that towards break even. When we look at our marinas, we did see some strong performance through the first 3 weeks in May, so this number is going to significantly catch up and start to break even with where it was for last year and eventually surpass. Wildwood, this is a new addition for us this year that we just picked up, and you can see that we're seeing some benefit of that already through some of our dock rentals there. And Emerald Necklace is performing strongly. And then the restaurant also, at this point last year, we were doing some renovations. It's now in full swing. And you can see that we're getting some more on the revenue side. We do have some more cost in there as well, because obviously we have to staff up with merchandise and kitchenwares. And again, that'll translate to revenue as the season goes on. So continue quickly. I just wanted to highlight Ledge Lake. It's off to a nice start this year. You can see that last year at this time, it was about $14,000 in revenue. This year we're already at $23,000. And the surplus is at $13,000 versus $8,500 at this point last year. And that is the quick overview, nothing really remarkable or outside of what we would have expected. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Moving on to new business.
Good morning, everyone. With us this morning, we have three rangers for swearing in. I'd like to invite Bryce Gordon, William Jackson, and John Myers to the front, please, to take the oath of office. While they're coming up, Bryce is formerly with the University Hospitals Police Officer and has an associate degree with Kent State. William has a very varied background for veterinary medicine, board certified in surgery, emergency medical technician, master's of business, and he came from Cleveland Heights, and John Myers came to us from the Southwest General.
Perfect, welcome. Please raise your right hand. Repeat after me. I, insert your name. Do solemnly swear, that I will support the Constitution, and the laws of the United States of America, the Constitution and the laws of the State of Ohio, and the rules and regulations, of Cleveland Metro Parks, and I will discharge the duties, of the Office of Ranger.
The office ranger,
to which I have been appointed, To the best of my ability.
To the best of my ability.
I will faithfully carry out and implement.
I will faithfully carry out and implement.
The policies enunciated.
The policies enunciated.
And the instructions given to me.
And the instructions given to me.
By the Board of Park Commissioners.
By the Board of Park Commissioners.
Of the Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
Of the Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
This I promise to do.
This I promise to do.
As I shall answer unto God.
As I shall answer unto God.
Congratulations.
The next guest we have with us is George W. Gunner, beekeeper.
Morning, commissioners. It is my pleasure to introduce and acknowledge George Gunner. In 1986, the zoo brought on a temporary exhibit when we brought the aquatics collection over from the Cleveland Aquarium. Changed the name of the primate and cat building to the primate, cat, and aquatics building. We could have changed it to primate, cat, and George because George came over with that collection in 1986, and he's been core to our aquatics operation since then. To have a temporary exhibit for 33 years is pretty crazy. and yeah, it was supposed to be 5 years. And George and the team have really built that aquatics department to what it is today. George has been involved in everything at the zoo, you know, helping out with events. I've seen George working the events for Who at the Zoo and for Twilight and all these other things. So he's been part of the zoo beyond aquatics. And I think it's really impressive that not only George has been here for 33 years, but it's a testament to his care that we were talking this morning. And there are some fish that are going to outlast George here. So we have some lungfish and probably about a couple of the cats.
In the gar,
that are actually going to be here longer than George, which is hard to believe. But I think it's a testament to the quality of care that we've been able to put in. And so I just want to say thanks to George and good luck in the future.
George, on behalf of Anthony DeRusso, the Board of Park Commissioners, we'd like to recognize you for your more than 33 years of temporary service. one of the highlights that I'd like to at least share is, you know, we also did lots of things after hours and, you know, taught aquatic classes for a local scuba diving club, and he actually served on the Big Creek Cleanup Committee, which is certainly a tributary that runs through the zoo. So we appreciated all of George's effort for his more than 33 years, and we'd like to congratulate him on his retirement.
Thank you. I'm just going to take a deep breath.
All right. next retiring guest we have with us is Barry Schrainer, technician.
Good morning. It is my pleasure to introduce and acknowledge Barry Schrainer. Barry is a mechanic for us in our fleet garage at Mill Stream. He started his career at the Metro Parks doing natural resources, doing wildlife management. He eventually moved into maintenance opportunities at North Chagrin and Rocky River. And then in 2013, when we acquired the lakefront properties, he was kind of the first guy on the ground and kind of solely started the revitalization of Edgewater Beach. He got so good at maintaining and cleaning the beach that he moved to fleet in 2015, and he got put in charge of all of the lakefront beaches and all of the equipment that goes with it. Anytime you mix sand and a mechanical process together, things just don't go very well. So Barry's gotten very well adapted to maintaining, fixing, and ultimately rehabbing all of our beach equipment for the park district. So his professionalism, his positive attitude, his attention to detail are the three things we're going to miss most about Barry in the Mill Stream Garage. So thank you for your dedication and all the best to you.
Thank you.
So I happened to run into Barry this past week, and I'm like, are you coming to the board meeting? He's like, because I don't know. And I said, you know, it's one of the great things that I think this organization does really well is recognizing people when they come into the organization. Certainly we see them through presentations throughout their career here, but recognizing them for their dedicated service. So it was really glad he chose to come today, again, to be recognized. He reminded me that he was actually coming to the beach before we actually had taken over the properties, because we were trying to get the system up and running, and that's a true testament to the dedication. And when I look at his career here, the different jobs that he's hosted and done, and the work that he's done, it's truly remarkable, and we congratulate you on behalf of Anthony J. Russo, the Board of Park Commissioners, and the entire staff for your 28 years of dedicated service.
Thank you. Thank everybody. It's been a great career. I appreciate it.
I just got to add, consistently, the first thing that we heard when we took over the lakefront was how the beach at Edgewater was pristine every morning. People couldn't believe it across the board. So
I appreciate it.
Thank you
very much.
The next retiring guest we have is Terry L. Robeson, Director of Natural Resources.
Commissioners, it's my pleasure to finally recognize
the longest retirement.
several board meetings, and he's coming to see
you. Yeah.
He's literally leaving on a plane today to go somewhere on vacation. New Orleans. Terry's a prime example, and for me, the first person that I had retired for me. You don't truly know how much and how important someone was to you until they're gone. And after Terry's been gone, it feels like 6 months has gone by because so many things have been happening, and Terry's counsel was so important to me. And he really shepherded the division through a time of growth and change from a previous director who had a very different leadership style than Terry. And he was a breath of fresh air, and he had a good demeanor, and he really stewarded the land, the division, and the Metro Parks, being that front-facing department, whether it's land acquisition or capital projects. Himself and his team were integral to all of that. So what I'll miss most, though, is his friendship. We were able to have very frank discussions. He was able to be respectful and challenge decision-making in a way that was very beneficial to the department. And he wrote me a very kind thank you for his party, his going away party. I can't read it because he uses very colorful language. as well, he provided a lot of spice to our staff meetings, which I miss as well. So big shoes to fill, and I really want to congratulate you again.
I feel overdressed sitting every day Saturday, Terry. Again, on behalf of the Board of Park Commissioners, Anthony J. Russo, we're recognizing you for your more than 10 years of dedicated service and the most recent roles as the Director of Natural Resources. His plaque reads like kind of a history lesson through the agencies that he's worked with. And it's truly about partnerships here, because we can't do anything alone. And when you read National Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Forest Service, U.S. EPA, USDA, APHIS, there is a whole host, Great Lakes Restoration, the countless universities. There's got to be 15 universities that we've had to partner with. And it's truly a testament to his leadership style to be able to manage all of those people and projects and sometimes egos and opportunities. And he's done all of those things with dignity and respect, which are a part of our core values. So, again, on behalf of the Board of Park Commissioners, congrats.
Exciting, and recently, I think a lot of you know, my mother-in-law passed away, and I was blessed with really good in-laws, but it taught me something in that we're really not on Earth very long, and this park system was put there for the people, and the natural resources is why they come, and this crew, this natural resources crew, is really, really good, so just count on them for giving me good advice on how to move forward and how to make decisions on what to do. But thank you so much. It's been great. Thank you.
I didn't mention the fact that he's a Nittany Lion fan. That's insane. I would like to recommend the board recognize Joseph T. Bonner Jr., George W. Huner, Barry E. Schrainer, and Terry L. Robeson for their years of service to the Cleveland Metro Parks and Greater Cleveland community.
So moved.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Next action item is 2019 budget adjustment number 4.
Thank you, Brian. The following amendments are requested for board approval, totaling $272,541, the explanation for which can be found on 44 to 46. The large items are a donation from Holden Trust for $100,000 for East 72nd Park improvements, $100,000 of insurance reimbursement proceeds for Whiskey Island Marina repairs, and $57,000 of revenue from a project with the American Red Cross for an open drone map. So the recommended action is that the Board of Park Commissioners approve the 2019 budget adjustment number 4 for a total increase of $272,541.
So moved.
Seconded. All in favor?
The next action is the adoption of one change to the Metro Parks Codified Rules and Regulations. Rose?
Yes, this change to our code really supports the board's prior adoption of the boat launch fee and will allow enforcement if necessary for those folks who don't comply with it.
Recommended action falls on the bottom of page 13.
So moved.
Second. All in favor? Aye.
The next two opportunities are related to grant activities. Authorization item number E to accept grant application and commit funds for the Beach Leaf Disease Project. The Metro Parks will be committing cash and salary to help expand surveys for the presence and absence of beach leaf disease and help continue to develop the protocols related to this. So the recommended action to enter into a commit is falling on the bottom page of 14.
Seconded. All in favor?
The next authorization to accept grant application and commit funds for the Emerald Ash Borer, not to be outdone by its friend, the beach leaf disease. We will continue to monitor and work with our partner, the U.S. Forest Service, for this long-term mitigation strategy. It provides a number of different opportunities to chemical treatments to help protect this tree species. The recommended action falls on the bottom portion of page 15 to enter into the agreement with the United States Forest Service.
To approve.
Second.
All in favor? The next action item is a change order to the asphalt parking lot improvements. Bids came in very favorably. We continue to work with our contractor, Arbicus Construction Company. We are able to add Rocky River Nature Center and the Rocky River Reservation to do a grind and overlay of 5,600 square yards of the existing parking lot. The change order falls in the bottom portion of page 16 to enter into the change order with Barbicus Company. This was done at the request of Cleveland Metro Parks staff.
Move to approve.
Second. All in favor?
The next item number is contract amendment RFP 6344B, Bonnie Park Ecological Restoration and Site Improvements at Millstream Run reservation. This is to bring the guaranteed maximum price of Mark Haynes Construction Company, this design build services for the Bonnie Park Ecological Restoration and Site Improvements. We're happy to be bringing this forward. We are still in a few finite discussions with the Ohio EPA, just kind of tweaking things as we're going through, but we are confident that the guaranteed maximum price will not change. However, recommended action to enter into the GMP falls in the mid-top portion of page 18.
Move to approve.
Second. All in favor?
The next is a professional services agreement, preliminary engineering services, Norfolk Southern Railway. As the commissioners know, we have been working diligently to provide access to the lakefront from the Cleveland Foundation Centennial Lakeland Trail. As we have been working to engineer over the railroad tracks, we continue to work with Norfolk Southern to comply with their engineering, construction, and operation asks. Part of it has necessitated us to come back to the board for additional funds, as we do pay for those as part of this process. We have asked to move the number up in an amount not to exceed $60,205, as we have had to go back a number of times and review things and tweak things for sight lines and curative portions to the construction of the bridge. But this does hopefully give us enough opportunity to finally bring this project to closure. We have started relocating the utilities already with the anticipation of getting final approvals and being able to go to bid late August, early September.
So just a question, we pay them to review the funds because they need to review them.
Yeah, they use a side company as well that then okay. Goes back and then we move forward. So whether it's a company like AECOM or one of the others,
yeah.
They only have so many staff per location, and depending okay. on the order and scale of the project, the positive is that they're reviewing and they're moving forward on
sure.
The positive and the negative is that we're not quite where we need to be yet based on some of the design reviews, but the team had weekly updates and phone conversations to continue the progress relative to designing and building this bridge.
Right, thank you.
So recommended actions on the top portion of page 19.
Move to approve.
Second, all in favor?
Aye.
The next is the tabulation of awards and bids. We have a host of them. The recommended action is on page 20, but commodity usage reports, asphalt pavement improvements. We did open our bids, got very favorable bids. We will be doing sections in Brecksville, Bradley Woods, and Millstream Run Reservation as we continue to keep up on our pavement management plans. Zoo various grains, aggregate stone, topsoil mulch, fuel oil, a few utility carts, various food purchases, and wireless phone and data services. Recommended action is on page 20.
Move to approve.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Vouchers and payroll?
Yes, we can probably combine these two resolutions with the absence of Commissioner.
No.
I'm sorry?
Two separate, please, Bill, just because for reporting purposes.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
The first of which is 19-05-054. The following vouchers have been reviewed and approved in terms of legality of expenditure and conformity with the Ohio Revised Code in a total of $8,073,715.14, and we recommend that the Board of Park Commissioners approves this resolution.
Move to approve.
Second.
The second resolution is number 19-05-055 for a total of $80. Again, the voucher has been reviewed as to the legality of expenditure and conformity with the Ohio Revised Code with a recommended action of approval.
Move to approve.
Second. In favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, moving on to public comments. I know we have a few folks today who want to start us off. Do you want to start?
Sure. Thank you. Mark. When you hear an article on Ranger's name change, made me wonder how money is best spent for the safety of the public and protection of the park. Today, you are swearing in more officers again, yet coverage remains thin. Are you losing that many people? If so, why? It takes years of experience to make a really good officer, knowing the area, reading the public, deciding what merits attention. Even with those skills, it is still critical to be there when and where you are needed. Not in transit between locations. It takes time and manpower to deal with something as simple as dogs off leash. A woman was recently injured when a loose dog attacked her horse. It has become an epidemic. And dog owners think they can get away with it. If we don't have enough man, woman power to enforce safety regs, then we should slow down adding new areas. Hills has many problems and will need extraordinary efforts, but you can't neglect the legacy parks without consequences. I notice there is now an officer sitting outside this room, even though there are others inside. Better to have him out patrolling. Parking lot and boat launch violators don't put the public at risk. Substituting petty enforcement for positive public contact will invite comparisons with the Cleveland Police Department. You risk alienating some of your staunchest supporters. Do you really believe you need to charge your taxpayers to launch their boats in public waters? Do you really believe you will ever make a profit given the huge initial outlay for equipment and software, both of which will need maintenance? I can't even find where the $80,000 launch equipment is entered. It's not under Emerald Necklace Marina or Enterprise Avenue. The end result will likely be more enemies rather than more money. And then, more than $250,000 in unused vacation buyout and workman's comp suddenly appears only 4 months after the budget was approved. That was known about at year's end. Again, is $340,000 really better spent on golf carts than on safety forces? Cart rental and food may be what keeps golf operating in a black, but it's a questionable business model to maintain golf courses just to get money from food and carts to make up for golf losses. A lot of sustainability means just limiting purchases. Resources go into making stuff which is later discarded. Recycling was always a challenge, but is really hard now. You deserve credit for recycling the boat ramp. The banners everywhere are visual litter. Instead of marketing everything just to make the parks friendlier, more welcoming. Free boat launching, big fields for kids, kites, and the horse community. Don't forget, these are the folks who actually pay taxes to you, unlike downtown renters or abated condos. You might want to stay on the good side. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan.
Yeah.
Thank you. Who else has a comment?
Hi, my name is Norm Plonsky, who holds neighbors of the Red Line Greenway against the Franklin Connector for taking public parking for my business and causing a dangerous intersection. And the connecting to your Centennial Trail, that report has come in with just a base overview. And I'm sure you'll get better information from your people, but just a quick overview. It was, the ground is slipping slowly. There is no bulkheads. Someone's going to have to pay for the bulkheads, and that process will be pushed down the road because the only people that care about paying for it are you and the City of Cleveland, and the City of Cleveland doesn't have money. You guys do. But two of the things, and then you're going to have repairs on your path in the future. There's fissures opening up right next to your path down towards the end of Carter Road. If someone took a couple steps off the path, they would find a 2 foot wide, about 3 feet long fissure, a couple feet deep, where their foot would drop into the ground and bad things would happen. But two main things of the report says the river is essentially eroding at the toe of the slope. At the low strength layer, leaving the slope substantial for failure. Without supplemental stabilization work, these slopes have a high probability of failure. That's in the report that was done by the people that the City of Cleveland hired that also does work with you guys. Doesn't mean the slope's gonna fail now, but it could one day. So with your Franklin Connector hurting my business, causing a dangerous intersection, your other trail, probably gonna be under repairs, probably gonna be closed if you ever do the bulkheads for a year or so, depending on how long the project takes. Just wondering if we can maybe slow down on the Franklin Connector, wait to do the project with the park and the Riverbed bulkhead project, which the City of Cleveland has now posted signs saying stabilization project coming soon. So, maybe wait, do it all at the same time, right? And not have issues on Franklin and issues on your Centennial Trails, and just not look good for you guys in the public eye. Thank you.
Sir,
just to clarify, these are two separate projects. They're not similar projects. They're not this one, or meaning the Tiger project has a certain set of funding and a certain set of parameters on it. The Centennial Trail, working with, I would say the port has a very vested interest in this, as well as one of the largest employers in town. So those projects are being coordinated very effectively along the way.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Yes.
Please.
I'm John Gill. I'm here today to make certain that you're aware that there's a different perspective about the need for both climbing anchors and towards ledges. This perspective can't be expressed by an outside group like the Ohio Climbers Coalition, nor can it be expressed by a commercial interest like the guiding surface who stand to benefit from the use of the bolted anchors. While on the surface, I share some of the same concerns and motivations as the OCC. I expect that the result of placing the bolts will be at odds with the mission of the Metro Parks. The bolted anchors should be considered to be a form of infrastructure. Infrastructure in this case is a change that we make to the environment so that people can safely experience the park, that is, access it, and also to preserve and maintain the quality of our natural resources when they're used. A boat landing would be a similar example of infrastructure. They have some obvious differences, but they share similar environmental safety impacts. They both should merit the same level of consideration when they're planned and used. I believe that the bolted anchors at Whips Ledges were installed with the goals of promoting accessibility and preserving the environment. I agree that the bolts will draw more and different people. Because I visit that park every weekend, I've already seen it. The park is a much more crowded place than it was in March. However, I don't believe that they'll improve the safety of the park and that they represent an attractive nuisance. I believe that they'll result in accelerated erosion and vegetation loss at the top of the ledge due to increased repelling traffic. Repelling is really the only way that these anchors can be used safely. Success of bolted anchors at Clifton Gorge, Springfield Gorge, Med River Gorge, and other places is largely due to the fact that they're used from the ground up. They're set up as support routes to be approached from the ground, and they greatly reduce the traffic at the top of the ledges. Clifton Gorge and John Bryan State Park was closed for access reasons in part due to erosion and caused by climbers. The anchors placed at Whips Ledges are not accessible from the top. They're too far down the ledges in order to be used safely without repelling. You can't reach them. There's pictures that I distributed. I'll give you a copy after I finish here. They require the climber to rappel across the edge of the ledge to set them up. And I have to say the safer and lower impact methods of setting up an anchor have been used at Whips Ledges since at least the 70s. As I've said, I've taken some pictures of the bolted climbs at Whips Ledges and attached them to a letter that Jerry Miller sent. They show the vegetation at the edge of the ledge, as well as the bolt anchors. I've included a statement reflecting the OCC's ambitions about putting more bolts in at Hinckley, and also some statistics from the American Alpine Club that rank repelling and lowering from anchors as the third and fourth most significant sources of injury behind injuries sustained by direct fall. In conclusion, I don't want to see anyone hurt as a result of trying to work with the anchors. I want to preserve access to climbing at Whips Ledges. I look forward to working with the park in any way I can to help improve the situation.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. We have your information that you submitted, so I appreciate that as well.
Hey, also, John, my name is Giuliano, and this Bolton is pretty, I think it's very unsafe. We've been going out there for 40 years, you know, and they said they want to bring more impact, they want to introduce people to to recreation. Now, you know, more impact that there is losing a lot of vegetation throughout the years from people walking over. And the simple climbing, seeing it all, is going to bring more impact to the chalk situation, you know, put chalk on the rock and to facing. It's a wrong thing, you know. I think it's a wrong thing, and I think they should focus more on the trails. We do a lot of work out there, we've got a lot of garbage, you know, and yeah, trying to make it safe. I think this bone is pretty psychoanalyzing, you know. Keep be able to do it from the top. We are meeting out there with a couple of guys. Say this is how you guys should do it, but they wanted to find this coalition's way. The future is the bone for us. No, man, it's like my class. I've been going under since I came from Europe. I love that park. I think the metro parks really don't care about it. I think they could do better maintenance. You know, now you guys put these signs up so people can walk around a mile so they don't get lost. You guys put beautiful signs up before explaining the ecology and all that. I don't know how much money you guys spend. They get vandalized. It was beautiful, educational. With these stupid signs, hey, you gotta go this way, mile, quarter mile, you know. That's ugly. We're supposed to money. So, yeah, some more trail minutes. That'd be really nice. Maybe put up some signs. No spray painting. Spray painting would be, you know, fine, chiseling. Try to protect it. It's the only trail we have here. It's one of the most beautiful parts around.
Thank you.
You know, so. I got more to see, but we're going, you know.
Thank you.
I think you guys are going to have some problems how people are going to fall. You know, like you got to fall down, you got to get lower down, and it takes away more from vegetation. I think you guys can go, let's say, safer way to set up top roads.
We will look into that. Thank you very much for the comments. Any other comments from the audience today? All right, let's move on to informational items, please.
We have a number of information briefing items with us this morning. We have one employee guest, Rita Scroby, and she's our payroll manager.
Good morning. Pleased to present Rita Scroban, our payroll manager. She came to us just over a year ago from career in the private sector in payroll. In a very short period of time, she's done amazing things. I think it's tough to overstate the impact that Rita has had on every employee, full-time, part-time, seasonal. Payroll is a position that every 2 weeks the work has to be done. It has to be done perfectly and on time. Rita's done a great job of dialing in the process there. Rita is also involved in implementing a lot of new initiatives and setting us up for the future in terms of best practices. And it's, I think as an organization, we're
thank you. I appreciate it, and I'm really proud to say that when I run into people, or a couple weeks ago I was at Edgewater for a 5K, did a walk, and just the people that were just so impressed with Edgewater and the way it looked and how they say they come down to Edgewater Live and just really enjoy it with their family and stuff, it just makes me very proud to be able to say that I work for the Cleveland Metro Park, so thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Rita. You're welcome.
I echo Gary's sentiments. Rita's been a breath of fresh air in the payroll department. She's done a fantastic job. And like I said, she's on the hot seat every 2 weeks, making sure that our employees get taken care of with their pay. The next information item is the Water Trails Partnership effort.
Morning.
Good morning.
There's three of us for this presentation. The reason is because a water trail really requires some interdepartmental work. It's pretty complicated to get designated, and we're currently working on two water trails. Outdoor recreation, planning, design, and park operations represented up here just to work on these water trails, not to mention that we work with park districts and municipalities on them as well because there's so many stakeholders and land managers. So, we're currently entwined in two water trails. What is a water trail? A stretch of lake or river or waterway has been identified and mapped as a trail. The land managers manage their access points to keep them safe and available, put up signage, teaching safety education. And once you've achieved all that, you get designated by the Ohio Department of Natural Resources as a water trail, and your mapped water trail will exist on the ODNR website to help paddlers find safe and accessible water trails to use. Comes with a lot of challenges, not just all the land managers managing the access points, but as we all know and talk about a lot, is water quality, river and lake conditions, freighters, motorized boats, safety, and dams. Currently, we are working on, all three of us are involved in working on two different trails. One, an effort that's been going on for years, the Cuyahoga River Water Trail. Ashley will get into some more details on that. That involves 11 land managers, including Cleveland Metro Parks. So that can, that's a challenge, but we're getting there. The other we've just started, and Kelly's going to talk in more detail, is the Lake Erie Water Trail stretching across Cuyahoga County with the potential of being joined by other counties along the lakefront to stretch along the whole southern coastline of Lake Erie. I'm going to pass it over to Ashley for some details on the Cuyahoga River Water Trail.
A little bit about the Cuyahoga River Water Trail. It begins where the East and West Branch merge. Here, and it runs 85 miles long. It runs south into Cuyahoga Falls before it turns north again, before it dumps into Lake Erie, only 32 miles from where it began. So it's a very unique river. This water trail encompasses, its watershed encompasses six counties. It is a large resource for a variety of paddlers. It offers a wide range of opportunities from our beginner-friendly sections in the gorgeous scenic area and the livery-heavy area of the heritage section, moving into our whitewater waterfall gorge section that's appropriate for advanced paddlers only, moving through a heavily Cuyahoga Valley Park section into a section that finishes in downtown Cleveland. The partnership is looking for designation this fall. It comes with a few key features, including cooperation among partners for the length of the river, public engagement, which happened this past fall and was positive, paddling brochures, including mapping, and designated and approved access points. The partnership is a robust one. It includes 15 stakeholders, which are organizations and invested businesses, and then as well as managing partners, which are entities that own and manage the access points. There's 11 of those, including Cleveland Metro Parks. The partnership is excited to celebrate a fall designation in a year where it's celebrating the 50-year rejuvenation of a river that once earned the moniker Burning River. So the section that is closest to our hearts and our home is the Burning River section. While it is not unlike some of the other sections, it is unique in that 6 miles of it is a shipping channel. It is a federal navigation channel. So while that presents unique challenges, it also brings amazing benefits of paddling in an urban area and the culture and history of it. So a little bit more about it. It plays host to all kinds of users, such as paddlers, rowers, rowing sculls, the good time jet skis, and hulking freighters that are as long as the Key Bay Tower is tall. So this area requires a good bit of education. We encourage all users to carry equipment that allows them to listen to and track the passage of these big transiting vehicles, and to know the river well. Some of the education that's been done are brochures, our brochures like this one, and overall education of the water trail will improve the paddling access and safety.
So a lot of the discussion of the water trail has kind of evolved. You know, when we first became involved in the Cuyahoga River designation effort, they included a stretch along the lakefront. And we quickly learned, you know, talking with our outdoor recreation experts and our, you know, marine patrol, that those are such different conditions. We really want to separate those out and designate them as separate trails so that we can really focus the education on those different types of conditions. So as part of the master planning last year, we looked at kayak access in Huntington and Rocky River, and then we've moved across with the lakefront planning this year to look at Edgewater, Wendy Park, East 55th, the Gordon Park area, and Euclid Beach. And so really we have enough access points just standing alone as Cleveland Metro Parks, but what a great opportunity to work with our neighboring communities and talk to them about the effort. So we've had preliminary conversations with Rocky River, Bay Village, Lakewood, the City of Cleveland, Bratnall, and the City of Euclid. And a lot of those folks are really enthusiastic too. So the yellow points are additional proposed access points that we're gonna look into to really make that Cuyahoga County water trail pretty robust. So we'll have a kickoff meeting in a few weeks where we involve a number of internal stakeholders and then these lakefront communities and other entities working on the lake to look at this designation effort. And it's, I think both these water trails are really a great example. You know, when you get right down to our core of conservation, recreation, education, what better way to get people familiar with the resource, get out and enjoy it, and just learn more about their surroundings. So that's just a quick summary. Again, a lot of work from a lot of different departments is going into this, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
I have a couple questions. So on the river trail, it's not continuous the entire way, is it? Is it possible to get a very small?
It's almost, there is a section, and I don't want to misspeak, let's see. The section through Lake Rockwell, is a drinking water source, so here in Portage County, mm-hmm. there's no paddling permitted on Lake Rockwell. With the dams in Cuyahoga Falls, that's another area that you need to get out and portage around. And I think other than that, works pretty well clear.
Okay.
That you could traverse the whole.
But the maps and OBNR's information will let people know that obviously there's spots where they have to get out.
And that's part of the effort along the lake too, that we identify any hazards or places that people really need to look out for submerged rocks or, you know, the river is so dynamic.
Right.
That's going to be changing a little bit.
Yeah. Well, that's going to be my other question. Some of the lakefront property obviously is not inside the breakwall, it doesn't mm-hmm. go far enough. Mm-hmm. Just what kind of information do you share with, you know, inexperienced paddlers, and so that they understand how changing those lake conditions can be? I mean, it's great for someone who really knows what they're doing, but I just get concerned.
And that's a place too that I think with our recreation experts and the folks at ODNR, the signage will be pretty detailed there.
Okay.
And I think even like the water quality, you know, the same way we do with the beaches where we have the now cast, mm-hmm. I think that can help talk about wave conditions. You know,
And that'll be where people put their boat in so that they can really mm-hmm. better understand all that. That's great. So.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you all very much.
The next information briefing item we have is the zoo rainforest assessment. Chris?
Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning.
So when we do onboarding new Metro Parks employees, one thing that I tell new Metro Parks employees is that, you know, the zoo is not certainly not the largest reservation that we have, but it's certainly the most facility dense. We have the most buildings, the most infrastructure in one place as opposed to any other place in Metro Parks. And as a result, that requires my team, my facility operations team, as well as coordinating with planning and design to really work to make sure we're, A, maintaining that infrastructure, in addition to just the sexy stuff that we come and talk about, a new capital project, particularly as it relates to animals. So there's a lot of things that my team's doing on a daily basis that don't necessarily come before the board. Some of these things we've covered in previous board meetings in terms of infrastructure updates, like the new slate roof on Wade Hall. In terms of old infrastructure, this is old as it gets. This was, you know, the original deer barn in Wade Park in 1882, I believe it was actually installed. So this is about as old of infrastructure as you can get at the zoo. But there's a number of other things that we're doing in terms of improved access. We've recently been working on the entire deck walk up to the Primate Cat and Aquatics Building, rebuilding that, adding items as far as infrastructure is related, particularly as it relates to new standards. So this is fire protection system in all the older barns in Wilderness Trek. That is an AZA accreditation standard that we've been working on. We have a number of older bear exhibits and a number of older exhibits, and we're looking at improving those through these types of climbing structures, which provide shade and complexity and some enrichment opportunities. This was all done in-house by our staff, so it's a way of maintaining these older structures by providing some enhancements to them. And then there's some things that guests just simply, we hope they never see, new water lines, new sewer lines. Much of this work, again, is being done by our staff internally. And once our paving project is done, this slide is for Jim, because I know how much he likes a good paving slide. We're actually doing a lot of paving throughout the zoo. Not only does that fix a lot of the damage we've caused by bringing construction equipment in and out of the zoo, but it also fixes a lot of our grade issues and making sure that we're accessible throughout the zoo. So this is an ongoing project right now that's going to be really important for the look and feel of the zoo moving forward. But the one big piece of infrastructure that exists in the zoo is the rainforest. And this building was opened in 1992, and at the time it was really cutting edge. One of my staff actually mentioned earlier that this building was actually built around the same time that the whole Gateway project was done. So if you think about, you know, the Gund and the Jake, they'll always be, you know, those to me. Those have gone significant renovations in the past few years. We're talking about these buildings being, you know, coming up on 30 years old. So while we've known that there's a lot of capital that we need to invest in maintaining in the zoo, in the rainforest in particular, we wanted to do a little bit deeper dive. And in many ways, the rainforest was built a little bit before the construction technology was available. Because what we were trying to do is create a tropical rainforest environment year-round in a temperate climate, right? And that was a new concept in 1992. It was really exciting. But what we did, because this was the construction technology available, is we reflected all the light coming into the building, and then we created a lot of internal lighting structures to grow this plant life. We're creating a hot, humid rainforest environment, which doesn't necessarily work well with a lot of building systems. So what we're trying to do is maintain all of this in an environment that quite honestly, it doesn't work for a lot of mechanicals. We've done a lot of infrastructure improvements, particularly as it relates to wood. Wood doesn't do well in this environment. The Rainforest Gift Shop was updated in 2012. That's been a nice enhancement. We've done updates to the food court as recently as last year. But we know that there's some critical systems that we need to put some work into. So with the help of Sean's team, we put out an RFQ in 18. WISG&E came in and did a full facility assessment on the rainforest, because while we know about some of the pieces, you know, we want to truly try to address some of these bigger, deeper dives. Again, we've been doing some things. This has worked with Viscom, where we put, you can see the little white dots on the window pane on the left. That's really helpful, but it becomes a much more complicated project when you're talking about putting it up 30 feet in the air. So these dots are simply to prevent bird strikes inside the building, because this is an aviary, but it requires a lot of coordination between Viscom, my team, planning and design. We actually closed the second floor aviary, the rainforest, to be able to do some of this work. And part of that was to make sure that we're getting a lot of these pieces that are really hard to access. The building is wonderful, it's complex, but it's really hard. It wasn't designed with maintenance in mind. This ceiling is actually a drop ceiling, where these are metal mesh panels that are there instead of the standard ceiling tile. None of these were attached, so that's fine, but when you have birds that fly up and maybe hit that and bump it out of place, there's a potential for birds to get up in that space. Since I came as a curator in 2008, we wanted to tie all that down, so when we closed the aviary, we were able to reattach all of those. All of the lighting, all of these strips of dozens of lights used to be high intensity lighting, high electrical use lighting. We've been changing them all out to LED as we go through the process to increase the energy efficiency. Again, this technology wasn't available when we built the building, so that's why the change. But really the question is, what's behind the curve? This is a little bit symbolic, but also from an accessibility standpoint, this path is a little bit crowned. It was intended to look like a natural path. When we have a busy day, it's hard to get one person through this path, let alone wheelchairs and traffic going in both directions. So we know that we have a lot to do. Wiss Jenny helped us really identify what those items are and put some price points around it. So I'm going to go through and show some slides. It's some really unsexy stuff, but it's the reality of what we deal with. This is the mammoth air handling unit that exists in the rainforest. There are multiple chillers, multiple boilers, most of which is original infrastructure. So we're coming up on 30 years. We're probably past life expectancy for a lot of these resources. We know in particular, we've done some boiler work over the past couple of years, but it's getting increasingly hard to A, just maintain the materials, but B, find parts for the materials, because a lot of this technology is out of date. So we know that there's going to be some major investment in the HVAC infrastructure. Elevators, the elevator just goes up one floor, but in order to provide access, it's an important piece. We do regular maintenance on that. At some point, we're going to be nearing the end of life for the elevator structure. So we want to make sure we have that price in mind and be able to plan that out as we move forward. And the filtration, this is an immensely complicated building. And it's one of the things that makes it great from a visitor's perspective, but we have filtration systems for all the different water features. We've got fish, we've got amphibians, we've got birds, we've got just general water features and mammal exhibits. So all of these filtration systems need to be maintained. And if they're not, any water leaking on the second floor is obviously gonna cause damage on the floor above. You didn't necessarily want to put the core of your your water heater on the second floor of your house, because there's always the potential for a failure, but we have those kinds of water systems all over the place. And then there's just all of these technology systems that go throughout the zoo, these mechanical systems. This is just the section for sound. We've got fire suppression all over the building in a number of different areas, animal areas, public areas. The phone system, how this plugs in, is always amazing to me that anyone can make this work. Anthony and his team, all the wires connected in there. And then the electrical panels, the high volume of electric usage that goes into this, all of these mechanical systems. We want to get a good idea of what's our cost, what's the timeline on that, and then are there upgrades that we can make along the way that are going to provide some additional efficiencies, and does that move that project up a little bit further in the process? And then there's the roof. This is an 87,000 square foot building. The roof alone is 37,000 square feet, has a number of skylights in them. Again, we've reflected ultraviolet light and then tried to grow plant material inside. One of the things that I'd like to see is that these skylights allow UV light to pass through moving forward. That helps the animals, that helps the plant life. But again, 37-year-old roof, well, the roof's not 37 years old, but it's an older roof, and then 37-year-old skylights. But quite honestly, the biggest feature of this entire building is the geodesic dome. This was kind of the signature when the building opened. This is every bit of 37 years old, and it shows it. In terms of access, getting to the top of the dome, we've had this event that's been unserviceable for about 8 years, I think it's been. Just don't have the ability to get access to that top of that dome safely. Many of these glass panels are cracked, or the glazing that provides the connection there is failing. So what happens if you've ever been in the rainforest on a rainy day? It's a rainforest. It rains in the rainforest exhibit. It's made more complicated by the fact that we have this orangutan exhibit that's underneath the dome. The tree, which you can see a little bit on this side, actually extends up into the dome. So the top of the tree actually goes up into the dome. And then the perimeter of the dome is surrounded by this soffit here. And what we're seeing now is that there's a number of these cracks and glazing failures are dripping into the soffit. The soffit had a rubber liner, and the intention that there was going to be condensation, that there might be small leaks, that water would be sort of funneled into a drain system that's in that soffit. That rubber lining in the soffit is 30 years old. So we were addressing that. And what happens is that water drips down. We have We have the researcher's hut that has this nice tented, so it's very authentic. It feels like you're in a tent in the rainforest. But it is a lot of maintenance. This was actually replaced 2 years ago. You can see the water and the mold accumulation. We need to fix the dome is the short answer. We need to fix the dome, we need to fix the soffit. And we're looking at ideas to implement those changes. The water drips on the actual soffit itself. We actually pulled this section back last year to make sure that it wasn't structurally unsound, It's structurally sound, it's just not very pretty. So what we're gonna need to do is go back and clean all this up, make sure everything's attached properly, make sure the HVAC system is working properly. But these are major investments, and what we wanna do is prioritize when we're gonna put the money into it, how's that gonna impact guests? Because there's really no way for us to do this work and keep the building open at the same time, or at least sections of the building open at the same time, because everything's just so intertwined. This is gonna require some advanced planning so for us to be able to sit down and figure out what are the next steps. There's some exterior envelope issues as well. This just gives you a scale for how much air we're moving. These are the vents into that HVAC unit, that air handler. But when you zoom in, you can see some tuck point issues, some masonry issues in the general building envelope. After sitting here talking for 5 minutes about how much we have to put into this building, the building's in remarkable shape for 30 years old. But it's a 30-year-old building. We just want to be smart about prioritizing how we're going to deal with this. And then on the front of the building, all of this granite is attached with this clip system. And you can see that the clip system is starting to deteriorate. And while it's not to the point of failure yet, we want to make sure we're well ahead of the point where granite slabs could be coming off the building. So we're going to have to invest in this granite face of the building long term. And then the entire front side of the building is all of these glass panels, all of the glazing, all the glass associated with that is going to be a pretty high cost to be able to maintain that. This building is core to our operation. It's what transformed the zoo from really what was a seasonal attraction to a year-round attraction. It's what took our attendance up from well below a million people to well above a million people for the entire lifespan of this building, 28 years now, 27 years. So we want to be able to make sure that we're investing in this. So I'll take you off track a little bit and say, when we were planning the grill exhibit, we brought this plan forward, and I won't go into a lot of the detail here, but just to say that the general concept was this space here was essentially going to be greenhouse space that would hold the animal exhibits. And we were going to use a different material on this as opposed to the glass that was reflecting light. We were looking at utilizing this ETFE roof system, which allows light to come in. Commissioner Rinker saw this in practice in a couple places. This is a new technology, but really provides a different experience as opposed to reflecting the light. It actually allows it in, so you don't have to use these high-intensity grill lights in the space. We are also going to include some new restaurant and food service and restroom space. You can see animal holding in both these spaces here. So we had a crazy idea. We know, but part of the reason we haven't acted on this is because the price tag was more than we wanted to pay, particularly given that we're gonna have to invest a lot of money in the rainforest. So what we wanna do is explore the idea, can you take this greenhouse concept, the rainforest already has some great animal exhibits, we're gonna have to put money in the rainforest as well. It has orangutan holding already, which was going to be built out as part of this project. It has food service and restrooms, which, while they need to be updated, isn't gonna come at the same cost of building them new. Can we take this greenhouse concept and add it to the rainforest? So Sean's team did some really great work. This is really just a massing exercise, but the idea here is that this is the core rainforest building. You can see the dome there. We're gonna have to invest in that no matter what. But all of that rounded glass panel, so here, all of this goes away. And the idea here is that you put this becomes our new rainforest exhibit. So it's not all ETFE like that original gorilla design, but it's the idea that in this space, you put the gorilla and orangutan exhibits, you can utilize the existing orangutan holding, you have restrooms, you have food service in this space, as well as a number of really popular animal exhibits. This is where the core of our reptile, amphibian, and insect populations, birds, there's a lot of core populations there that you can leverage this. So what this was an exercise in, are there efficiencies here? Can we avoid some redundancies and put this all together? And this is just a rendering of what that space might look like. So we're not sold on this. We've got a lot of due diligence to look at, but on the surface it looks like, as opposed to investing all of the money that's gonna be required to maintain the rainforest and build an entirely new gorilla and orang exhibit, there appear to be efficiencies and opportunities for us to fit this in and combine those as two projects.
You need the rope bridges too.
Well, absolutely. That's included. That's absolutely in this design. But this is an idea, this is Sean's team, really excellent work on, does the concept work? And I think what we've seen here, at least what we've felt, is that the concept work. We need to invest in the rainforest, that's a core ability for us. We think there's probably efficiencies here, it fits. from a space perspective, and there's some economies here that really work for us. So we're going to be bringing more of this information forward. We're talking about this with the Zoo Society Board in terms of what are the opportunities here. It's not just a refresh of the rainforest. That doesn't sound sexy. It's going to really be a transformational piece to the rainforest. Doesn't mean it's going to look like this. Doesn't mean it's going to be exactly the scale. I think the concept really works. So we can invest in the infrastructure that we have and really enhance it and really drive attendance and drive guests.
On principle, that makes a lot of sense.
So that's what I have right now. I just wanted to give you an update on that rainforest facility update piece. Throw this out there because we're really trying to think strategically. If we're going to invest money over a 10-year span in the rainforest, let's figure out the best way to look for those efficiencies.
What might the timing be on this? I mean, obviously there's a lot to be done, but how soon do you need to start investing in the rainforest and some of those critical places?
Well, last year?
About 15 years ago. Right now what we're dealing with, we need to deal with the dome.
The dome, that's what I was
like
thinking.
Immediately. The other thing that we're going to need to deal with more immediately is the chiller systems. So we have redundant chiller systems. We just started to fire them up for the season because it's now just getting to the point where we actually need the chillers in the rainforest. One's pretty much dead. And the other one that we've been able to keep going, mm-hmm. Should get us through most of this year. The team's doing a great job putting it together. We're going to need to invest in that chiller system. So we're going to be putting money into the rainforest, and I've been earmarking money for these kinds of projects as we try to figure out, what's the true cost? But some of these things, as far as the rainforest go, are going to have to happen
immediately.
We've been talking about a way to move forward on the dome system. We're still fleshing out those details, but there's a suggestion that if we went with ETFE, which would be a really great opportunity for us to explore the usage and the practical application before we invest in a big new space. If we did that, there's lead time on that product. So figuring out what that lead time is, I would expect we're going to bring forward something for you all to vote on as an action item relatively soon, because we're going to really need to address these issues. The water issue and the chiller issue are the two main things that we're addressing right now.
Thank you.
The Wildlands building is enormous.
Yes.
And then the one in England, in Chester, was much smaller. Between those two, the scale of what you're looking at adding on here is
so
for Chester.
I think. So this expansion here, as drawn, is about 30,000 square feet. The gorilla exhibit, as proposed from the design team, I think was 40,000 square feet. Wildlands was 100,000 square feet, and I think that Monsoon Forest was somewhere around that 37,000, okay, somewhere in there, square footage. So it's similar, but we're not talking about, at least in this design, it's a smaller square footage of the actual ETFE material. Again, this isn't necessarily the design, but we're talking about the same size as the Monsoon Forest in terms of additional space off of the rainforest. And remember, this is 87,000 square feet as a standalone. Now that's including some of this as well, but this is a 37,000 square foot roof. So double that, 74,000, that's in the existing rainforest.
But the experience they had is really, it's worth looking at.
They both swear by it, and then I've actually also been to the Burger Zoo. They have four buildings that have this roof material in it. One of those buildings is 25 years old and it's never been replaced. So there are some, we still don't know what the true maximum lifespan of the material is, but if you're talking about a flat roof or any kind of roof material, you're talking probably 20 years, maybe less, before you're having to do something with it. So I think there's a cost benefit there that we can really explore.
Thank you.
Yeah,
very good update. I applaud the team internally for really pivoting and looking at this. And as Chris laid out when we were talking through all of these things, this is a very practical solution and a very strategic solution to enhancing the rainforest infrastructure, as well as complementary bringing on a new exhibit and tying it all together with the ultimate goal of increasing stay times throughout the
If you can make the hybrid, that would be good.
Next item is Park Run with a small P in Cleveland Metro Parks. Nancy?
So in 2017, I went to England on vacation. I was looking for some activities, looking for a 5K, and I discovered Park Run. Park Run is always spelled with a small P to reflect its grassroots and modest nature. It's a weekly timed 5K. It's always free. It happens all over the world. In 17 countries, there's 1,300 park runs. They're family-friendly, dog-friendly. They have names for that. They call people with dogs bark runners. People with kids in carriages, they call pram runners, because pram is it's very English endeavor. There's no boards, there's no t-shirts, there's always this post-run social. There's no pressure to be fast. There's always walkers, joggers, dogs, kids, families. It's very welcoming. One of the things I liked about Park Run is their values. Being in Metro Parks, being CAPR accredited and have receiving the gold medal from the National Recreation Parks Association, has aligned itself pretty well with the three pillars: health and wellness, social equity, and conservation. The Park Run values also align with those three pillars. They value diversity, healthy communities, and stewardship of public lands. And I really like the values behind the event as well. I think it has a nice social equity piece in that it's always free. Park Run started in the UK in 2004 and came over to the US in 2012. This bottom one right here is actually the one that I participated in Winchester, England in 2017. This is just a screenshot to give you the idea of the distribution. It's, the UK is very crowded with park runs. It's spread into Europe. There's some in Russia now, South Africa. There's about 30 in the United States, with 10 in development, including ours. And it's also big in Australia, but that didn't fit on the map. So when you participate in Park Run, you sign up on the website once, and that's it. And you can walk up to any park run anywhere in the world. My barcode is on the back of my phone. I can scan it and run their park run. Your results go onto your page. These are my results, which I hope you can't see very well.
Is that 20 minutes?
I was really fast in 2017, and I have dropped off greatly since then. I've only done three park runs, but you can look at your page, and you can see park runs all over the world if you're a traveler. And so now there's a thing called park run tourism. So when people travel, they look for park runs to do so they can collect them. And then you can look at your page and see park runs from anywhere you went and did them. And it's just kind of fun because people like to collect things. So I'm a park run tourist. Everywhere I go, I look to see if there's a park run. Sign up, or you don't have to sign up. You show up and get your barcode scanned and run it. I'm not going to get into the weeds of the timing. It's very simple, but I haven't done it yet, so I don't want to misrepresent it. You use your barcode that day. They scan your barcode when you come over the finish line. They scan your finish tag. This is the scanner. This is the timer. Plug it all into software that Anthony's going to help me with. And it matches your profile, your place, and your time. All for you, and then that goes on to your profile page. We are not the first in Ohio. There's one in Mansfield, Ohio, and there's one that's just started at Star Parks at Sippo Lake in North Canton. Those are the other two that I've done besides the one in the UK, because those are the closest to us. They've both been very helpful in us planning ours. Starting a park run. Park Run has a national representative, national office that helps you through the process. You choose a course, you recruit volunteers. Park Runs are always, always operated by volunteers. You pay a one-time fee of $5,000 for the equipment, the software, website support, use and support, and support from the national office. That's it, you don't pay anything else, and no participants ever pay for anything. Train the volunteers on the timing system and the day of run roles that they play. Soft launch to start, because you don't want to have 200 people showing up when you are just learning about the equipment. Star Parks had 64 people at their first run. So we're currently working on this. We are looking at various locations. We don't have a course yet, but when we do, we'll be ready to submit our fee and start training volunteers and get park run going. Hopefully this fall.
Just one course to start?
Oh, yeah. Debbie.
Well, it's going to be hard to pick a location now.
Every Saturday.
It's 52 Saturdays a year.
It is every week, right? Okay.
And I have a couple of that the national office connected me with that wanted to start a park run in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And I want to, we're going to draw on Cleveland Metro Parks volunteers. We think they'll really like this opportunity. We want to create some leadership in that group so that I don't have to work 52 Saturdays a year. Nobody should have to do that. So we're going to try to build a team in the first park run. Mm-hmm. And we have talked, you know, in theory, over the next few years of doing like north, south, or north, south, east, west, wherever we want to locate them. So yeah, that could happen. It could grow.
Good. That's great. I just heard about these recently, too. I think it's a really cool idea.
Yeah,
it's nationally linked together, so.
It's a lot of fun, and you don't really, describing it is one thing, but doing it is a whole other experience, and you just get hooked.
We're also trying to find a place that hasn't been used before, because we have a lot of very traditional, long-standing 5K and 10Ks and other runs. Because of the consistency factor that it's run every single Saturday, it actually comes in front of like a lot of the other areas. So that's why Nancy paused. We want to make sure that the place that we pick is actually sustainable for a long period of time and has not been used before. So we're trying to find something that's uniquely different.
And it's a 5K, you said?
It's always 5K. No awards, no award ceremony, no t-shirts, no big numbers, nothing. Just go up and do it.
That's cool. That's a great idea.
Thank you, Nancy.
Yeah,
thank you. Next update is Fascinated Naturalist Field Guides, the next iteration in inspiring exploration.
No sales in
there. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Stephanie, who work up at the Ocean Shore Nature Center as a naturalist, and I'm here to tell you about one of the little gems of outdoor experiences that we've been working on and starting. So this is a collection of guides that is out there now. I'm going to physically place new things, a couple that you can pass around. These originals, I started on the scene somewhat later. Jen Brumfield is responsible for initiating the series in 2005. And she went to BizCom and she illustrated a lot of these originals with colored pencil. So what you see going around of the butterflies and moths, that's not one of the guides, but that's a foldout that she designed and did all that artwork. So I had to give a really big nod to her because this was for baby. And I've gotten involved in the past couple of years with a couple guides. So we have a diverse range of topics, and some of these topics are a little bit more obscure, I want to say, or unique, because we try to feature things that maybe are not out there already as far as field guide topics go. But we also try to hit on some common things that we can highlight in specific range of our park system. We hope that we will be coming up with our latest one on fish. And this is the one I'm going to talk to you about today, but that in relation to the entire series. So these guides have been great. We sell them in nature shops. They're affordable. They're great. They're given as gifts. They're convenient. People can carry them around. As I said, the topics range quite a bit. I am slightly not doing this because we are celebrating this guide. Am I snapped that? But as you can imagine, it's not a topic that a lot of people acknowledge all the time, but yet they're out there and they're everywhere. So we're trying to encourage this exploration of our parks. And just to go through the guide just a little bit, I have to give a nod. Stuart Pearl, our photographer for a lot of these images that you're going to see as an audience today. And he did a phenomenal job with his camera, making these tiny snails and slugs look fabulous in relation to the guide. But there are many people who were involved, and they all deserve a big thank you for that. The idea behind this guide came from a seasonal that we had in Brecksville, Joe Harris. And his breadth of knowledge on this kind of interesting topic was just so extensive. But there are no guides out there that really cover this. So we thought, well, let's do it. Let's put something out there that isn't out there yet. So in conjunction with him, I kind of helped to assemble the guide, did some illustrations. This has been something, not just this guide, but the fern guide, mushroom guides. I've gotten emails from teachers of classes saying that they've used these because they are so simple and easy to use. And yet, they point out the common features that really make identification
easy in this sense. So lots of ways to get that information out into the people. This is the part where we do lots of programming and outdoor experiences, but at some point, you know, you want people out there and exploring on their own. And these guys, I think, are a key or an avenue to get people out there. So we give information about where these local flora and fauna might be. And if you want to find them, there's a checklist. Check out all the snails and stuff you can find. Why not? You know, they're out there. So we're trying to encourage a lot of different interest models. So five things you may not have ever known that may be your interest, not. Snails and slugs have a toothed tongue called a radula. Heliculture harvests their mucus for skin care. Anybody? They have both male and female reproductive parts, so when you move that slowly, if you find a potential mate, you know, we'll help each other out in that way. Further that, there's some that have what's called a love dart. So they chase each other, they bite each other, and then they spear each other with the love dart, which has hormones that increase the odds of fertilization for that snail. So, and then the mucus, of course, that makes them unpalatable, but also as in transportation. So they've got a lot of cool things that maybe as you're just walking by, you know, right? So, a lot of interesting facts.
That's super.
But this is basically the main idea. What do these things have that impact us? Why are we looking at them? Why are we studying? Why have a field guide about them? Because once you're curious, once we get you fascinated, you pursue that knowledge, and that knowledge leads to understanding, and then you start to care about it. So because these are specifically about our park system, our flora and fauna, they're kind of collectible. They kind of encourage you to get out and go and explore and see things. So here, that if anything has not hooked you yet, these are the cuteness photos for you to become enamored with some of our different snails and slugs that you will find. And then, of course, I leave you with the deepest and most profound question you can imagine is, if you could be a slug, what slug would you be? You have options. You can be a hard slug. You can be a guardian slug. A toga man slug. A hedgehog slug, which is my personal favorite. Or a three-band slug. So that's what I have to present to you.
Stephanie, how much are these little books?
They're $5.
Okay. They're really cute.
I'm glad she went last, so Chris didn't have to top that. No, I was like, slugs and snails.
5K of the snails.
That was absolutely fantastic. Again, that's what makes Cleveland Metro Parks great, is a talented team that have put these wonderful guides together. We very much appreciate it. Commissioner Zara is no old business. The next regularly scheduled meeting is Tuesday, June 11th, and there is an executive session.
Is there a motion to go into executive session for the purpose of discussing the purchase or acquisition of real property?
So moved.
Roll call.
Debbie Barry?
Yes.
Bruce Sprinker?
Yes.
We will be back. You do not need to wait until we will end the business in our executive session. Thanks, everybody, today. Enjoy the wonderful morning.